We're living at a very interesting time, certainly politically, but also I think an interesting time in a more general way. One of the things I found most striking in America is the emergence in the last few years. We're living at a very interesting time, certainly politically, but also I think an interesting time in a more general way. One of the things I found most striking in America is the emergence in the last few years of a kind of new atheism, of a kind that has not existed before. Now, we've had atheists in America for a long time. In fact, when I first came to America in the late 70s, if you said atheism, you would think of somebody like the activist Madeline Murray O'Hare. Some of you might remember her. Or some kind of a rumpled ACLU lawyer. I mean, this was not an atheism with mass appeal. The new atheists are a little different. They're educated. They're sophisticated. In some ways, you may say that some of them are even culturally kind of cool. I'm thinking not only of people like the physicist Stephen Hawking or the Oxford biologist Richard Dawkins, who spoke here about a year ago, but also of people like Christopher Hitchens, who writes every month in Vanity Fair. I've debated Hitchens about 10 times now, and usually when I'm getting ready to debate him in the dressing room, he's sitting before the mirror, artfully messing up his hair. Or he shows up on the podium with a glass of whiskey, and he's dressed in a kind of trench coat, giving him a sort of child molester look. But in a kind of appealing way. And you've got the Harvard cognitive psychologist Steven Pinker and the physicist Larry Krauss and the philosopher Daniel Dennett, and you can go down the list. It's an impressive list. These are the new atheists. And their agenda is very different from that of the old atheists. The old atheists basically were a little unimaginative. All they cared about is policing the boundaries of church and state. Let's take down the Ten Commandments from the Alabama State Capitol. Something like that. The new atheists are much more ambitious. Their goal is to demolish belief in God, obliterate Christianity, create, if you will, the purely secular society. And the new atheists have, I think, very effectively and in some ways cunningly targeted young people. Many of them say, well, you know, we know the Christians are a majority, but that's okay. The Christians can breed them, they can have the children, but at some point they're going to have to send those children out into the world. Well, that's when we're going to kind of get them. We're going to use our influential positions in the media, in the academy, in education, and we're going to use the techniques of knowledge, questioning, skepticism, interrogation, to challenge the assumptions of the believer, to kind of put them up against the wall, if you will, to see if they can defend their faith or give it up if they can't. And this new atheism, I think, is making inroads. I would say that within America, atheism is now a viable option among young people in a way that I don't think it has been in the past. What I want to do today is engage this new atheism, but engage it really at its best. In other words, in a debate, you don't do that. I've been debating a gallery of atheists. A lot of them, by the way, are educated a little bit beyond their intelligence. But it's a very interesting encounter. And in a debate, you always look for the weak points of your opponent. logical errors, historical fallacies, intellectual whoppers, and so on. But I'm not going to do that here tonight. Tonight I'm going to focus not on the weak points of the new atheism, but on the strong points of it. Because I think that if you can answer the new atheism at its best, then you really have a sturdy foundation for sustaining theism, or belief in God, or in my case, specifically, Christianity. In the talk I'm going to give this evening, at no point will I appeal to Scripture, or Revelation, or sacred texts, or holy books. This is an argument on the basis of reason alone. It's an argument that will draw on history, philosophy, science. In other words, it will engage the new atheism on its own ground, and at no point appeal to authority. Now, in thinking about this new atheism, well, give you a feeling of what this new atheism sounds like. I was reading one of the texts of one of the leading new atheists, and he was talking about the war on terror, the war against terrorism. And he said that if you look at this war that's been going on since 9/11, he said it's really a war of competing religious fundamentalisms. Over there, Islamic fundamentalism. Over here, Christian fundamentalism. What do these two groups, he asks, have in common? They are both feeding their fanaticism at the same holy gas station. In other words, religion, belief in God, is the problem. He said belief in God is what causes people to do crazy things like fly planes into buildings. In the view of this atheist, 9/11 was, quote, a faith-based initiative. And looking around the world, he says it doesn't stop there. It's not just a matter of the radical Muslims. He says all over the world, people are fighting and murdering each other and killing in the name of God. Why are the Israelis fighting the Palestinians? They're fighting about God. What about the Shia and the Sunni in Iraq? They're fighting about God. What about the Hindus and the Muslims in Kashmir? The same thing. What about in Northern Ireland, the Catholics, the Protestants? So he said, this is a terrible legacy. And if you look at history, it's more of the same. The Crusades, the Inquisition, the religious wars, the Salem witch trials. He says any rational guy would have to conclude that belief in God is a menace to civilization. If we got rid of God, if we had the God-free society, a secular society, it would be not only more scientific, not only more rational, it would really be more peaceful, more decent, a more moral society. So this is a little bit of what the new atheists are saying. Or to take a second example, the atheists are really good about coming up to a young Christian and saying, hey, Christian, you're supposed to be a Christian, but have you conducted an independent investigation of all the religions and belief systems in the world? No. You're a Christian because your parents are Christian. You're a Christian because you were born in Dallas or Oklahoma City or Wichita, Kansas. You're a Christian by the accident of birth. Had you been born in Afghanistan, you'd be a Muslim. Had you been born in Tibet, you would most likely be a Buddhist. So your Christianity is not the matter of reflection or thought. It is a matter of chance. And so how do you know that your beliefs are true and everybody else's are not? You have a holy book, but hey, everybody's got a holy book. How do you know that your holy book trumps their holy book? How do you know that when the world ends and the final curtain falls and there's a great suspense and the phone rings and you pick it up, how do you know that phone call isn't going to come from, say, Salt Lake City? Big surprise. The point being here that these are ways of challenging Christians, and particularly young Christians, And now, by the way, all of this comes at a time when I think many Christians are really very poorly equipped to engage this kind of new atheism. Why? Well, one reason is that Christians are typically educated to, when faced with a difficulty or a question, turn to the Bible, the source of wisdom. So if somebody says, how do you know that Jesus is the Son of God? You say, well, it says right here in the book of Matthew. It says right here in the Gospel of Luke. And by the way, that's a really good argument if you're talking to another Christian. But what if you're talking to a Hindu or a secular guy or an atheist? They're going to say, well, we don't care what the Gospel of Luke says. We reject the authority of the Bible to decide the matter. And then as a Christian, you're a little tongue-tied because that was your argument. There's a second problem that's worth noting, and that is that for many Christians, we get our Christianity when we are quite young. In my case, I was born in Bombay, India. I learned my Christianity from my parents at a very young age. Now, was it Christianity? No. Looking back on it, I would call it crayon Christianity. Why? It was a Christianity adapted to my very young mind. And I was 5 or 7 or 9. But many of us never outgrow that Christianity. That's the Christianity I brought to America at the age of 17. And that's the Christianity a year later that I took to the Dartmouth campus. Now, Dartmouth, like most of the Ivy League colleges, was founded as a Christian institution. Dartmouth was founded by a Yale congregational minister who went up into the woods of New Hampshire to educate and Christianize the Indians. Sometimes I wonder how I got there. I think I may have misread the catalog, the part about the Indians. But my point is that today, these colleges are very secular. And on the Dartmouth campus, I found myself subjected to a kind of skeptical attack. What? You're telling me, Dinesh, you believe somebody was born of a virgin? Walked on the ocean? Brought dead guys back to life? Are you nuts? Don't you believe the world operates by fixed laws? You think these laws can be suspended at somebody's whim or discretion? We're living in the 21st century. And so, faced with this kind of skeptical attack, I found myself becoming embarrassed about what I had been raised to believe. Not that I didn't want to believe, but my brain was getting in the way. And this is really, I would say, the strategy of the new atheism to drive a wedge between the mind and the heart. And therefore, I think it is essential to say, to meet this new atheism, if you will, on its own ground. And that's really what I'd like to do today. I want to begin by making an argument that might seem a little bit surprising at the outset. And that is the idea that Western civilization, but more generally America, and more specifically the values that even secular people or even atheists cherish, are values that they would not have if it wasn't for Christianity. This is, by the way, nothing different than what most historians believe, that Western civilization and America are built on two pillars, Athens and Jerusalem. The atheists will acknowledge Athens, but they often pretend as if there wasn't Jerusalem. But the truth of it is that Jerusalem has played as big, if not a bigger role than Athens. In fact, what we understand of Athens is seen through the lens of Jerusalem. Or to put it somewhat more bluntly, what are the values that atheists care about? Forget about the Christian values, faith, hope, charity. We're not going to look at those for a moment. Let's just look at what the atheists care about. What are Richard Dawkins' top priorities? Well, he believes in the validity and the autonomy of science as being an independent or enterprise to discover the truth. He believes in the dignity of the individual. He believes in the value of life, and particularly human life. He believes in the equality of women. He believes in compassion as a social virtue. He believes in the abolition of slavery. So let's make a list of all these values. Well, look at the list. Where do those values come from? I want to argue that they came into the West, and in some cases into the world, because of Christianity. Now, how do we know this? Well, one way you know it is you simply look to other cultures to see if these values are present over there. Consider compassion. I want to argue that compassion is a Western idea. In other words, compassion as a social priority, not just the feeling of it, but the importance of it. How do we know this? If there was a famine tomorrow in Haiti or Rwanda, what would happen? First of all, there would be a big uproar in all the Western countries. Tears of grief, a lot of emphasis on collecting food and sending Doctors Without Borders, the Red Cross, churches would get organized. Now, there are many other rich countries in the world. The Muslim countries, China, India is an emerging market economy. What would happen in those countries? They would look at the famine and pretend that it wasn't happening. There would be a relative yawn of global indifference. Why? When I was a kid growing up in India, we learned a proverb, the tears of strangers are only water. Now, this may seem like a very insensitive way to think. I want to suggest it is in fact the normal way to think. In fact, it is the Darwinian way to think. We are naturally attached to our family, then to our relatives, then to our community or tribe, then to our friends. And so the idea is that you owe obligations in increasing concentric circles, but the obligations dim as you go further out. And if some guy comes for help who's a stranger and who has a problem, you wish him well, but it's not your problem. Now, only in the West does compassion suddenly become this universalization of compassion, human brotherhood. Only in the West has this become an important priority. Here in America, we have a whole political party which has, you may say, moist eyes as its operating symbol. Compassion. Aristotle, another way, by the way, to discover the Christian legacy of compassion is just to go to ancient Greece and Rome before Christianity and look to see if you can find these virtues there. Now, Aristotle, by the way, makes a list of the virtues. Compassion appears nowhere on this list. Aristotle does not even discuss the subject. When he brings it up, he talks about pity. He treats it as a vice. It's a sign of weakness. So, compassion only becomes a virtue in Christianity. Or consider something like the dignity of human life. We know that the ancient Spartans thought nothing of taking the sick or unwanted child, depositing it on the mountainside in the winter, and finding it dead in the morning. And that's, by the way, not even the big scandal. The great thinkers of classical antiquity, Aristotle, Plato, Socrates, knew about this, but regarded it with complete equanimity. It was to them no big deal. Why? Because the idea that every human life is precious, or as we might now say, sacred, this was simply an idea foreign to ancient Greece and Rome. It comes into the West because of Christianity. Hey, these special effects are really adding a supernatural element to this. Well, I guess I'll keep going. Now, or consider something like the Sam Harris in his book, The End of Faith. He says, the Christians bear a heavy responsibility for slavery. In a sense, that's true. But what Harris doesn't seem to realize is that slavery has existed in every known civilization, every known culture. In fact, for millennia, slavery needed no defenders because it had no critics. It was like the family, taken for granted. Only in one culture, only in one civilization did slavery become controversial, and that is Western civilization. In fact, there is no anti-slavery movement outside of the West anywhere in the world. I should qualify this. Historically, there has always been one group that has opposed slavery. That group is, of course, slaves. And so, yes, you had runaways and slave revolts, but I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about what Abraham Lincoln meant when he says, as I would not be a slave, so I would not be a master. Lincoln doesn't want to be a slave, we get that, but he doesn't want to be a master also. He's against the whole idea of it. That is a Western idea, and I want to go further, it is a Christian idea. Now, in a recent debate with the skeptic Michael Shermer, he made the argument, he said, well, the Christians took mighty long to discover this anti-slavery impulse. He goes, it took Christians in the modern age, in fact, which happened to coincide with the Enlightenment, blah, blah, blah. Which is actually factually all wrong. The truth of it is, slavery was abolished in Europe between the 4th century and the 10th century. When did Europe become Christian? Pretty much in the 4th century when Constantine converted to Christianity. Between the 4th century and the 10th century, slavery in Europe was replaced by feudalism or serfdom. Not exactly a walk in the park, but nevertheless, very different from the idea of being owned by other people. Slavery spread in the New World subsequently, and so you needed a second wave of abolition, which was led by the Quakers and the evangelical Christians, who basically said, the Bible tells us we are all equal in the eyes of God. Therefore, no man has the right to rule another without consent. And this idea becomes the basis not only of anti-slavery, but also, if you think about it, of democracy. Why? Because democracy is based on the same idea. No man, no person has the right to rule another without consent. So, where am I going with all this? What I'm saying is that even the atheist of today is standing on a Christian mountain. In other words, even the atheist wouldn't be what he or she is and believe the things he or she does and cherish the values important to him or her if a man named Jesus Christ had not walked the face of the earth. So the atheists are, you may say, suffering from a kind of historical amnesia. They won't acknowledge their debt, which carries to this day to the Christian legacy. So this is a historical point. It doesn't call on anyone to believe. It simply says, let's, in decency and historical accuracy, acknowledge that our civilization, our culture, is formed at its core by Christianity. Notice we're not discussing things like, did Benjamin Franklin go to church? We're discussing whether the core values of our culture, even values upheld by secular people, have Christian roots. And I would argue that they most certainly do. Now I want to shift gears a little bit and say a few words about science. I want to talk about science because atheism today marches behind the banner of science. The atheist argument is that science is a better way of knowing than Christianity. Why? Because science is based on evidence. Christianity is based on what the Bible calls the evidence of things not seen. That's the biblical definition of faith. So which is better? Evidence or no evidence? So the atheist account is that science is relentlessly advancing and religion, but specifically Christianity, is relentlessly retreating. And that as science discovers more and more, Christianity or God has less and less to do. And the general assumption here is that in ancient times when man was ignorant, people who couldn't explain things invoked deities. Ancient man looks outside a cave, there's a clap of thunder. Who knows where that came from? Well, that must have been the thunder god. There's a bolt of lightning. Whew, where did that come from? That must have been the lightning god. So the idea here is that as science begins to understand these phenomena, religion loses ground. Now, this notion has become very powerful in our culture. In fact, it has made its way even into our textbooks. Now, and this idea of science moving forward and Christianity backing off is sustained by a tripod of key historical examples. The Christians used to believe that the earth is flat for 1,000 years. Then the brilliant scientists showed up with telescopes and instruments and revealed that the earth is round. The Christians believed that the earth was the center of the universe. Sun went around the earth. But then scientists, starting with Copernicus and Galileo, showed that no, the earth goes around the sun. And then the Christians believed that God made every creature, each unto its kind. But then Darwin, sort of the patron saint of modern atheism, showed up to show that no, chance and natural selection can fully explain the diversity of life on the planet. You don't need to posit a separate and independent episodic creation. So this is the scientific story of progress. The only problem is that it hangs, as I say, on a tripod of key examples. And if you begin to zoom in on these examples, you begin to see that every single one of them is extremely shaky. Consider for a moment the idea of the flat earth. In college, I read Dante's Divine Comedy, and you realize that in the medieval era, educated people knew perfectly well that the earth is round. Dante's universe is based on a spherical earth. And then as you push back in time, you discover that educated people at the time of Christ knew perfectly well that the earth is round. And then I discovered that the ancient Greeks, who lived 500 years before Christ, knew perfectly well that the earth is round. Why? Because actually you don't need Galileo's telescopes to figure it out. All you have to do is watch an eclipse. Here's the sun, here's the earth, here's the moon. You can see the shadow of the earth on the moon. Hey, fellas, it's round. So, Aristotle knew that the earth is round. The historical fact is that this whole flat earth business is atheist myth. It's complete propaganda. It was invented by liars in the 19th century and has been mindlessly repeated by pseudo-educated people in the 20th and the 21st. It's based on no historical facts. That leg of the tripod is completely fallacious. Now, I could go on focusing a little bit on this, but I want to broaden the scientific argument by noting a peculiarity in the atheist argument. Science is advancing. Christianity is retreating. But you notice that the examples of how this is happening, they begin with the early centuries, they continue with the heliocentric theory, then they go to Darwin, and then they stop. It seems like the last good example was in 1859. No new examples for 150 years. Why not? Is that because science hasn't figured out anything since then? No, the most astounding scientific discoveries have all occurred in the last 100 years. The fact is that no new examples are adduced because the new examples cut the other way. The new evidence of modern science seems to push against the atheist hypothesis, seems to give almost disconcerting corroboration to the theist premise, and in some cases to very specific aspects of Christian theology. Now, this is a huge subject. I'm going to touch very lightly on it by giving two examples. The first one, probably a good way to tell it is about a question that was posed many centuries ago to the church father Augustine. And the question goes like this. If you think of time, time goes back, but however far back you go, you can always go further back, right? If somebody says 1,000 years ago, you can say before that was 1,001 years ago. 1,000,000 years ago, well, before that was 1,001,000 years ago. So no matter how far back you go, there was always the day before, the year before. Time does not seem to have a real beginning point. It extends indefinitely. Incidentally, so does space. Space moves infinitely, seemingly in all directions. So the question was, when did God create the universe? And what was God doing before that? Kind of an interesting thought. How did God occupy his time, which he evidently had a lot of, prior to creating the universe? To this question, offered in the 4th century, by the way, Augustine gave an astounding answer that does not seem to have occurred to anyone before him. He said, God made time along with the universe. In other words, before the universe, and the word before has got to go in quote marks here, there was no time. Once upon a time, time did not exist. Now, this is a very mind-bending idea. And for many centuries, it was scientifically incomprehensible. In the Newtonian universe, the idea that time has a beginning is absurd. Time and space are sort of infinites. Now, but today, if you send your son or daughter to study introductory physics at the University of Oklahoma, he or she will learn in the first 8 weeks that as a direct consequence of the so-called Big Bang, not only did the universe have a beginning, not only did all the matter in the universe have a beginning, but space and time also had a beginning. In other words, space and time are properties of our universe, which means that outside our universe or beyond our universe, if there is a beyond, no space, no time. So suddenly, you might say the Christian concept of eternity, which is not just forever, but in some sense God being outside of space and time. This concept, which was scientifically crazy, has suddenly in the last 100 years become intelligible. It's scientifically coherent. Space and time are not universals. They are local properties of our neighborhood. They don't operate outside it, if you will. That's one example. Here's a second one, and to me more telling. And it's particularly telling because it is giving incredible constipation to the world's leading physicist, Stephen Hawking, as indicated in his latest book. And this is a question that goes back about 30 years, a little longer than that. Scientists began to ask a rather interesting question about our universe. Not about our Earth, about the entire universe. Our universe, it turns out, operates according to certain very peculiar numerical constants. Some of these are the so-called forces of nature. If I pick up a pen and I drop it, it will fall at a known, not speed, but acceleration. Gravity, the speed of light, 186,000 miles a second in a vacuum. Why that speed? What if light were to go faster? What if light traveled at 102,000 miles per second? So the scientists who began to think about this began to ask, why does our universe have all these numbers, all these forces, all these constants, and why are they set at those specific numbers? What if it was different? One physicist, Lee Smolin of Princeton, says it's like this. It's like God is sitting at a desk with 100 dials. Every dial precisely calibrated to a specific number. And Smolin's question is, what if we scientists sneak in the room, and when God isn't looking, we fool with the dials? We move them a little bit. What would happen? And Smolin says that if you move them, in fact, here I want to switch to Hawking. Stephen Hawking says in A Brief History of Time that if you touch one of the dials and you move it, now he's talking about the rate of expansion of the universe. You move it, not 10%, not 1%, but one part in 100,000,000,000,000. You would have no universe. You would have no life. The entire universe has to be exactly as big as it is and have been around for exactly as long as it has and have exactly the numerical properties it does, because if it didn't, we wouldn't be here. The universe seems to be a giant conspiracy to produce, well, us. Now, this argument, sometimes known as the anthropic principle, also known as the fine-tuned universe, this argument has put modern atheism completely on the defensive. Factually, it is an argument that has never been even seriously challenged, let alone refuted. Now, I want to make an important qualification. We're not talking here about the specific qualities of planet Earth. Sometimes when I've advanced the fine-tuned argument, I am rebutted by somebody who's attacking a different argument. It's true that there are special things about Earth that make life habitable over here. But there are many other planets. There are many other stars. So you can say in a universe of billions of stars, we happen to inhabit the lucky planet that has life. That's not my argument. My argument is about the entire universe having to have these properties, because without it, no life would exist anywhere in the universe. Now, how can that be? Why does the universe look like it's designed in this way? How could that be possible? In his latest book, Stephen Hawking comes up with a solution. He says that this apparent design of the universe could be purely coincidental. It could be purely coincidental because it's possible that there are many universes. In fact, it's possible that there are an infinity of universes. Now, what is the empirical evidence that there is, apart from our universe, even one other universe? Forget about an infinity, forget about 10 or a million. What's the evidence that there is even one other than our own? None. In a debate with the leading physicist, when I asked him to provide that evidence, he said, I don't have any. And I said, well, but you're on the cutting edge of physics. Surely you're hoping that evidence will come in the next 10 or 50 or 100 years. He goes, no, we'll never have it. I said, why not? He goes, because if there are other universes, they would operate according to different laws than the laws in our universe. So maybe E equals MC cubed over there. And because those universes have different laws, they are eternally cut off from our universe. We have no access to them and never will. And listening to this, I said, man, I'd like to believe that, but I don't think I have that much faith. In other words, this poor sucker, to abolish one invisible God, has to manufacture in his head an infinity of invisible universes. So, this is the scientific debate, to give you a small glimpse of it, over God and Christianity. I have so much more to say about this, but I want to leave time for questions. And so I need, in the interest of time, to adopt the motto that King Henry VIII used with one of his wives. He said, I can't keep you too long. And so I'm going to fast forward a little bit. And I'm going to take head on the argument I mentioned earlier about Christianity and violence, about religion and the divisions and wars and terrorism and conflicts of history. I'm going to ask if it's really true that Christianity and religion in general have had this horrendous impact. I'm going to argue, based on history, that this is in fact not true. Now, like a lot of arguments that are in the end bogus, the argument does have a molecule of truth. In fact, all bogus arguments do. Sometimes when I'm talking to students, I tell them, if you hear an argument that's specious, that's wrong, always ask yourself, what is the grain of truth in it? Because if it didn't have a grain of truth, no one would ever believe it. So what is the grain of truth here? The grain of truth in the atheist argument is that the radical Muslims do what they do in the name of God. That's true. But there is nothing equivalent in any other religion. Where are the Buddhist suicide bombers? I'm waiting for those guys to show up. There's nothing in Christianity comparable to Al-Qaeda, Hamas, Hezbollah, no Christian country run along the lines of post-Khomeini Iran. Recently, I was watching TV and I came across on CNN a show called God's Warriors by Christiane Amanpour. It's all about how the Abrahamic religions lead to extremism. So Christiane Amanpour, one day she does Islamic extremism, one day Christian extremism, one day Jewish extremism. So okay, Islamic extremism. Well, there's a lot of material. 9/11, the Bali bombing, the London bombing, the Madrid bombing, the Mumbai bombing. We could go on. Christian extremism. Here is Christiane Amanpour in the hills of Montana. She's standing outside a trailer in which a 90-year-old guy sits on a rocking chair. He wants to blow up the world. True, he's broke, doesn't really know how to do it, but he's the Christian bin Laden. Be very afraid of this guy. Well, you see where I'm going with this. There's a bogus analogy here between Islamic radicalism on the one hand and Christianity on the other. But let's push the argument further. Is it true that the Israelis and the Palestinians are fighting about God? No. They are not fighting about God. They are fighting about land. And the Hindus and the Muslims, if you think about it, are fighting about Kashmir. And even in Northern Ireland, the Catholics, the Protestants, they're not fighting about the Eucharist or transubstantiation. They're fighting over which bunch of guys gets to rule that country. Self-determination, not God, is the driving motor of that conflict. There's a story about a guy who's walking on the street in Belfast. A man jumps behind him, puts a gun on his head, and says, Catholic or Protestant? And the man's kind of nervous, and so he goes, well, actually, I'm an atheist. And the voice behind him goes, Catholic atheist or Protestant atheist? Now, if you look at history, the crimes of religion are typically exaggerated, and the crimes of atheism tend to be ignored and minimized, even though they are much greater. Number of people killed in the Inquisition, over 400 years, fewer than 2,000. Works out to about 5 guys a year. Number of people killed in the Salem witch trials. Actually, my wife and I were in Salem a few years ago. I do want to mention that the witches today are doing really well. A lot of them are like tourist guides. Didn't see Christine O'Donnell, but anyway. If you take one of their brochures, you know, number of people killed in the Salem witch trials, they'll tell you, 19. 19. Now, is that 19 too many? Well, sure. Or 2019 if you want. But look, I mean, while the atheists are crying crocodile tears over the crimes of Christianity, crimes often committed 200, 500, in the case of the Crusades, 1,000 years ago, crimes really unrepeatable today. What's the probability of the Inquisition returning to Oklahoma City? These crimes have receded into the mist of time. Meanwhile, the much greater crimes of atheist regimes, more recent, much bigger in magnitude, and they're still going on. And people say to me, well, Dinesh, are we talking about like Stalin in Russia or Mao in China? Or maybe the Nazi regime in Germany? And I say, well, that's the mere tip of the iceberg. It's true that those three regimes, in a pretty short space of time, 7 decades, managed to kill about 100 million people. But that doesn't even count a procession of Soviet dictators from Lenin through Chernenko, Andropov, Brezhnev. It doesn't count Ceausescu, Fidel Castro, Kim Jong-il, Pol Pot. The list goes on. Enver Hoxha. Take a guy like Pol Pot. Nobody even mentions him. He's a junior league atheist. And yet, in Indochina, after the Vietnam War, his Khmer Rouge, in a pretty short space of time, about 3 years, killed 2 million people. 2 million. Even bin Laden doesn't come close. So atheism has produced a huge mountain of bodies, a massive ocean of blood. But who should parachute into the discussion at this critical moment but Richard Dawkins, author of The God Delusion, who says, wait a minute, we have to make a critical distinction. The Christians killed in the name of Christianity. You might have had some tyrants who happened to be atheists, but they didn't kill in the name of atheism. Now, Dawkins, as you know, is a biologist. And here I think we begin to see a problem when biologists are allowed to leave the laboratory. Why? Because evidently the poor guy doesn't know any history. All you have to do is crack open the collected works of Karl Marx. You'll see right in there that the atheism isn't incidental. It's absolutely central to the whole scheme. Marx says that religion is the opiate of the masses, the drug of the people. It numbs you to social injustice. So you have to get rid of it to create the new man and the new utopia, liberated from the shackles of traditional religion and traditional morality. So my conclusion is really a very simple one. Atheism, not religion, is responsible for the mass murders of history. And this brings me very briefly to my conclusion. And then I would love to open the door to discussion. I want to ask for a moment, what's motivating the new atheism? Now, to speak to atheists, you get the idea that what's motivating it is nothing less than an explosion of reason itself. This is the atheist trope. The atheist is a champion of reason itself. Years ago, Bertrand Russell, when he wrote his book, Why I Am Not a Christian, somebody asked him, what if you die and you find yourself in front of God? What would you say to him? And Russell said, I would say to him, sir, you failed to provide me with adequate evidence. So this is the pose, the pompous pose of modern atheism. The modern atheist fancies himself to be a disciple of the data, following the pathways of reason wherever they may lead. And the atheist says, if I don't believe in God, it's just because I just don't see the evidence out there. I want to suggest why I find this an incredible, which is to say unbelievable, account of the new atheism. It makes no sense. Why? Because the truth of it is that if you don't believe in something, because there's no evidence for it, what do? You ignore it. You act as if the thing that you don't believe in, for which there is no proof, did not exist. Case in point, I don't believe in unicorns. But you'll notice I have not authored any books. The Unicorn Delusion. The End of Unicorns. Unicorns are not great. I don't go around debating advocates of unicorns. I just live as if there aren't any. So, the new atheists, in their obsession with God, in the time and energy and emotional investment they put into it, suggest something else is going on, something bigger, something a lot deeper. I want to suggest, leave you with my thought about what that is. If you think about life, well, it's kind of unfair. We don't want it to be, but it is. When I came to America, one of the first phrases I learned was, what goes around comes around. Kind of a great saying, but it's not true. Many times the bad guy ends up on top. Many times the good guy comes to grief. What goes around does not always come around, at least not in this life. But it is the shared premise of all the great religions in the world that this life is not the only life. That in an ultimate sense, in a cosmic sense, what goes around does come around. There is cosmic justice. Consider Hinduism. You are a terrible jerk in this life, we'll be seeing you as a cockroach in the next one. Cosmic justice. In Christianity, it's the last judgment. The idea that your actions in life, even your thoughts, are being noted, are being observed, perhaps being recorded. Kind of unnerving. Not just for the atheist, even for the believer. So here's Augustine in the 4th century, praying, deferring his conversion. He says, I prayed to God, make me chaste, O Lord, but not yet. Even Augustine is chafing under this idea of unremitting moral supervision and moral judgment. So here's my thought. The modern atheist has found a beautiful solution to this dilemma, to this problem. How do you get out from under the shadow of unceasing moral judgment? Well, abolish the judge. If you get rid of God, then all the commandments, all the edicts, all the rules become optional. They're not handed down from above. They're made up by human beings. Suddenly, if you will, we have the possibility of moral freedom. So Dostoevsky says, if God is not, everything is permitted. Now Dostoevsky means that if you get rid of God, chaos will come in the world. But the modern atheist takes that warning as a message of liberation. If God is not, wow, everything is permitted. If God is not, I can live exactly the way I want. So my point is that what's driving the new atheism, in my opinion, is not simply rational arguments, although there are those, but also this hidden search for breaking loose from the shackles of prohibitive Christianity, achieving what can be called moral freedom. Thank you very much. Thank you.